As a quarterback, I love sports. But sometimes when I get hit on my blind side, front side, and put on my backside, I wonder, is Sport Clips better than sports? Because Sport Clips haircuts is sports on TV, plus a relaxing haircut, hot steam towel, and massaging shampoo, which is better than sports plus Sport Clips. It's a game changer. Check in online at sportclips.com.
Hey, everybody, it's Mark Pattison. I'm back again with another great episode of Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. And before we get into this week's episode, I want to remind people, if they want to follow my journey all the way to Mount Everest coming up in the spring of 2021, you can do that at www.markpattisonnfl.com. I have a blog. I will be adding more content as we get closer. There's also a app from Garmin. You can actually follow me all the way up the mountain and all the way back down, which is pretty cool. And there's a time clock of the day I actually leave on March 31st of this next year. Also, I continue to not only raise money and awareness, but also partner with Higher Ground, a fantastic philanthropic organization here in Sun Valley, Los Angeles, and New York. And it's all about this campaign I've been up to, Amelia's Everest, the Lhotse Challenge. So I'm really trying to tie in what I'm doing on the mountain to turn that light towards my daughter who has epilepsy and other people who have cognitive issues. A lot of it's surrounded around the military, amputees and things like that. So it's always a great cause. So have a look there. And of course, you can find 175 or more amazing podcast on really inspiring people doing incredible things. And I'd always appreciate a ratings and review on Apple. There's a little button. You can hit that and you can give whatever rating you want to give, but it helps give more exposure to what we're trying to do here on the podcast called Finding Your Summit. Okay, onward. Here we are today. I'm really jacked up because when I was a little kid growing up, I was in a and had the opportunity of living close by the University of Washington where I played football. I had a great run from 1980 to 85 under Don James. And I used to sneak into the games and with my buddies. And, you know, it was everything I could do to one day aspire to be like these guys. It goes back to the 76 killer days and everything else. Today, I have a former Husky and really excited. He's got an incredible story. His name is Kevin Richardson. Kevin, how you doing?
Good, Mark. Thanks for having me on. Really appreciate it. Old dog brother, you.
Yeah. No, thank you. I appreciate that. You know, there's a lot of crossover here. I think it was Dan Rayleigh. He's a longtime journalist. He now works for the company that I worked for, Sports Illustrated, covering all Husky content up there. And I think I saw your story, and it was really about something that a lot of times people, I think, see these guys like you and I on the field and think that they've got everything figured out. And the reality is that, you know, life after football, wherever that ends, it could be for high school for a lot of people. It could be at a major college like the University of Washington, playing really in the Power Five, as they call it today, or for some of us who are lucky to make it all the way to the NFL. It really doesn't matter because you got to face the facts that football doesn't last forever. And what you're going to do when you get done. So let's start back on a little bit of the beginning. You're a kid that was recruited out of Sacramento, California. I think your time up there playing for the Washington Huskies was a little bit before me in the mid-70s. And so just walk me through really like how you like your football identity and how it came to be that you ended up this kid from Central Northern California, whatever you want to call it, to the Pacific Northwest playing for the University of Washington in Seattle.
You know, it's interesting you tap on that right now, Mark, because before we got on this podcast together, I was revising a chapter of mine called Emerald City Dreams. And in it, it talks about my recruiting by Lambright and Ray Jackson. And, you know, back in the winter of 1972, during, as I was heading toward my senior year of graduation, and, you know, it just spun all kinds of memory wheels in me and deposited all those great things right out on the table in front of me again. And I'm sorting through it and trying to put the words together and kind of doing some edits on that chapter. And after I had already had close to, oh my God, I had probably close to 85,000 words that I'd been working with my literary agent. And then a few days ago, after talking to my editor, I had to kind of just tear into that old big heavy Hemi and start taking it apart again and putting it back together on how I was going to present this story and everything else. But my time going up to the University of Washington was something, it was Disneyland to me. Because I was, even though I went to a high school, it was very prestigious in Sacramento, California, Rio Americano High School, that was known for its Olympic caliber swimmers. I mean, Debbie Meyer, who won 3 gold medals in the 68 Olympics, was an upper class, you know, schoolmate of mine. And she's a dear friend to this day. And there was others, of course, that earned gold and silver and bronze. But, you know, that was and that reflection of this writing, she was one of the earlier inspirations for me as a kid to chase this potential dream of either playing Major League Baseball, or which was my first big love, just enamored by it, or football was the other side of it. And then when I became a senior at Rio Americano, you know, football season was over, got the, you know, post awards and things like this. And next thing I know, it was like trumping my baseball card. And it was like, here we go. You know, it's on. And I started getting these other recruiting colleges coming and knocking on the door. And what was kind of interesting in this thing too, Mark, is that my math teacher had gone to Nebraska, and she was close personal friends with Bob Devaney. And one day after class, she says to me, she goes, "Kevin, would you think about going to Nebraska? If you are, I can call Bob Devaney. He's a dear friend of mine." And I said, I don't know. I think all they have back there is corn and snow. I don't know if I'm really interested in that or not, right? So then when RJ shows up with Lambo, and they said what they said, and I had familiarity going to in 1962, going to the World's Fair, and then 5 years later coming back up to Tacoma at Lake Silicon, staying with my aunt again with my folks, you know, and there was this allure that was bringing me to that gym of the Pacific Northwest, the Emerald City. So it was like already in my DNA, you know, it's just a matter of taking that first trip, you know, and walking out of that tunnel for the very first time with Lambo and looking up and seeing that huge concrete monolith on the other side and envisioning people to the sky. You know, that was the magic and the allure and all that stuff. And the smell of that old tunnel, you know, you were a kid walking down that thing. And later on, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Yep. That rough stucco wall that if you braised up against it, you get yourself a little raspberry or strawberry. Man, it was like rich stuff back then. And it just got into your blood, man, deep. And the fans, I mean, dude, it's like nothing I ever experienced. I mean, there's talks of other campuses, you know, USC and Stanford and Michigan, Notre Dame, and all that, you know, rah-rah, the Southeast Conference and packed stadiums. But I'll tell you, there was just something magical about the setting of Husky Stadium right there on Union Bay that looked out into Lake Washington and out to the east. And man, it was just like, it was Disneyland for me, dude. It really, really was.
So getting back to where I was going originally, I think one of the things, again, if you haven't experienced it, and I'm going to like, you know, extend your thread, when you're going down the tunnel and you're there for 4 or 5 years and you're in that discipline of working out, studying film, being super competitive. And then, excuse me, through all that is the camaraderie that you have with all your teammates. And then you step out as brothers, you go through that tunnel 110 yards long, you go out on the field, fans are going crazy. You've got these big time colleges that are showing up, whether it's Alabama or USC, and you're playing against these guys, and it becomes very addictive. And so when we get into, and this is for all of us, when you get into like life after football, which we're going to get into, you know, how do you replace that drug? And that's the hard thing. And one of the things for me, you have your own answer, I have my own answer, is that I've found, and I work for Sports Illustrated, right? I mean, I'm in an amazing place, but there will be never anything that will ever replace that feeling of, you know, leaping up over the Michigan defender and falling down in the back of the end zone and the crowd going crazy and everything being, you know, spontaneous and winning in the last second. You just don't get that in jobs, right? And no. So when you're chasing that drug, when you're chasing that adrenaline, that feeling that you can get, which you do get in that arena, not many people get to do that. it's just hard to replace. And it's at that point where so many of us all at some point in time, you got to figure out a way how you're going to rechannel that energy from point A to point B, and whatever that point B is for each one of us. And we all have our different timetable of how it gets there. So now you're there, you're a defensive lineman, you're having a successful season. You're one of the main guys, you're big, you're strong. There's not many people who could stop you. As you like projected towards life beyond college, and now you're focusing more on the NFL. What was that to you?
Well, the thing it was for me is that, you know, that got me to that final fifth year. Mark, I was always kind of a late bloomer kind of guy. You know, I didn't really hit my stride in high school till my senior year when I peaked out, you know, and I had a really good senior year for what I did and going both ways and mostly going both ways all the time. But that really kind of launched me. And this is the thing that was attractive to Lambeau and RJ. And then as I got to the U, I ended up blowing out my knee in spring practice in 1973. Mm-hmm. And under the tutelage of somebody I never knew would come into my life, a guy named Forrest Blue, who lived in our neighborhood back home, I ended up having this impromptu lunch, you know, from a guy that he brought his son to my mom's daycare center in our home. And I sat there and I talked to Forrest, and he gave me the greatest sage wisdom in the world about moving on and down the road and projecting to the NFL, because that's where he was, you know. And he basically told me, he says, Kevin, he goes, you know, he saw my cast and all, he says, Kevin, no matter what your coach wants, you redshirt this year, take an extra class load, prepare yourself for the spring. You'll be miles ahead of everybody else. So I took that. And what ended up happening, Mark, is that I approached Ken Shannon, who was a track coach, legend, right?
Yep.
And he wasn't just that coach for another sport. He became a close, intimate friend of mine in the process, mm-hmm. you know, and a great tutor for me. And as I redshirted in 73, I approached him because we really didn't have any training. I mean, he was kind of just flipping on your own to go out there and do this and do that. I mean, it was like scattered. You know, if you were motivated, yeah, you got in there. A few handful of guys, that was it. You know, like Dave Worgan, you know, with Sunny Six Killer Group. He was a highly motivated guy, wanted to get in the weight room. So what happened is that I approached Ken, and he taught me a technique about my training and stuff. And so I needed to have a workout partner. And I looked around the Husky football team trying to figure out who that guy might be. There was only one guy that stood out, and that was Dave Pearr. And so I approached Dave right before the Washington State game in 1973 and asked him who he was going to train with. And he goes, well, I don't know, whoever shows up. Next thing you know, we become training partners. I become his personal trainer for the most part. We rub off on each other. And so his tougher mindset, street fighting mentality rubbed off on this teddy bear. Okay. And so when I became a senior as a fifth year, I'd finally found my stride. I was there. And I, at the end of the season, ended up leading the team in quarterback sacks and everything else. And my eyes were on the NFL draft. Coach Don James said, he goes, you'll be gone by the fifth round. You know, so, and benching 485 pounds and being told by one of my teammates, you know, that he overheard scouts talk about the tunnel, and they all said that I was the strongest guy in the country. And that just elevated me, because my housemates, two were Olympians, one with a discus thrower, the other one was a javelin thrower. And then we had like the sixth man on the Husky basketball team as a housemate too. So we had this amazing group of camaraderie, you know, we shared faith, you know. Not only was it competitive and little jabs here and there, you know, with your housemates and stuff, you know, yeah, to kind of lift your spirits some more. I also had it in the weight room with guys like Jeff Taves, you know, who was a sophomore at that time in 76, and Phil Foreman and a few other guys that tagged yeah. along that wanted to be part of that. And then there was everything else that went on outside of campus, my interest with the Fiji House, where I was a member of that fraternity, and all the stuff I was doing with Fellowship of Christian Athletes, with Mike Rohrbach and Mike Baldison and Jeff Leland. I mean, that whole thing was galvanizing the person I projected myself to be on the NFL platform the following spring, you know, at the draft. Well, it never happened.
I was just about to ask you where it all fell apart and where it really got tough for you.
Yeah, I'd have to say the thing that really, you know, the thing that really broke my back was after the Indiana game. And leading into that game, the first game against Virginia, Don James, and I don't think they still had that award when you guys were playing up, but he initiated this thing right at the start of the season for the defense and the offense, the big hit award.
Yeah, we
had it. Was like, okay, right. Yeah. So whoever got that, it hung on your locker for the following week, you know, and everybody walked by and go, I want that on my locker. Right. So I won it the very first go. I was the first guy to ever won that award on defense. And the next week we're playing against Colorado that went on to play in the Orange Bowl. I was lined up across from Hasselbeck, preseason All-American, future second round draft pick, you know, the New England Patriots.
Yep.
You know, and it was like, I had a great game. They ran away from me after the first part of the first quarter. And Doug Martin had been placed on the right side to take Dave Browning's spot because he had a little groin pull and was nursing it that week. And so at the start of the second half, Coach Mo decided, Kevin, I'm going to put you on the other side and we'll put Doug back over, who's your backup on the left, so there's more compatibility. And, you know, because you can play anywhere and Dougie really can't. So as soon as they did, they started running away from me. Next game against Indiana. The night before the game, I walked up. Remember, we used to have the training table down the crew house. You walk down there before the games, and then you board the bus and head over to the hotel in Bellevue. Yeah, and you watch a movie, and all the rah-rah starts. When I walked in there, I walked up, and sitting right in front of me was Moritz, who was right, was James, who was left, was Skipper Hall. Uh-huh. And I told Coach Mo, because we had this great working relationship with each other, I said, man, Coach, I don't know what it is, but I just feel really drained. Like I just totally flush out. And the moment I said that, Don James looked at me, his face, you know, how I could get it really beet red and just like it was going to blow up through the top of the thermometer. He looked at me like that. And I almost thought that he's saying to me, you pussy, suck it up. You're one of my team leaders and you're my starting defensive tackle. You're the strongest guy on the team. Mm-hmm. You know, shut up, you know? And it's like, it just kind of hit me. The next day, I went out and I still felt flushed out. I didn't know what it was. And then Monday, and we ended up getting beat. And Monday, you know, I go through my routine, walk up to the roster that was by the manager's window all the time, you know, at the start of the week. Yep. And I happened to notice that Doug Martin was put ahead of me, even though I graded out higher than him. And I played like, we had like 84, 85 downs on defense. That's like two games in one Saturday. And Dougie was only in there for 11 of them. So what happened basically for the next five games, I stayed on second team behind a freshman kid who Coach Mo had asked me to be a big brother to mentor to, put him under my wing, get him in the weight room, help him with whatever, you know. Sorry. And I loved it. I thrived on that. Mm-hmm. And so we got the last three games, ended up being put back on first team. And then when the season ended with our win over Washington State, at Joel Albee Stadium, my very last play as a Husky was sacking Jack Thompson in the end zone for safety, which turned out being a handoff from Warren Moon to Ronnie Rowland to eclipse that 1,000-yard mark for the second time in Husky history and allowed me to lead the team in quarterback sacks. When I got on that plane heading home, all of a sudden, I became very, very fearful because my whole thing was that I was going to start every game. I'd elevated myself. I was there. Everything Don James said to the media about me, the expectations they held and everybody else, the press, I mean, family, friends, everybody was just blowing out the window, you know? And it's like, nobody ever said why it was done, why Doug was put on first team in front of me. I was left spinning in the wind, twisting, unknowing, you know, I'm this big, passionate, gentle giant teddy guy inside, but yet I can be a Hulk in a second on the football field. I can flip that switch immediately when needed to, you know, and going into the season with my strength and my less than 10% body fat. I mean, I look like freaking Lou Ferrigno in football pads. I did. And there was no discounting that whatsoever. And everybody knew it. And it's like when this happened and I was put on a second team, everybody's jaws were dropping. Like, what's going on? You know, and then that plane ride home, it started to hit me. And it was like, that was like November 20th, 1976. Mm-hmm. And by the end of January, I was in full blown out, severe depression, suicidal ideation, creatively thinking of ways of ending my life. And that moment changed my life. I mean, completely. when I got to that process where I had waited for Freddie and Boris and Marco to leave for their day's activities, and I'd planned to end my life, I mean, it literally changed the whole course of my life.
So let me ask you this. So obviously it's a really deep place for somebody to get to. And
oh yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's an awful place. Right. And, you get to that level and you're not thinking rationally and you're not putting perspective into it and all that kind of stuff. What was it then that, if you were in this place, right, because of a mammoth disappointment, probably your whole self-esteem was all, you know, wrapped around, right? Yeah. This and now it's out the window and who are you and all this kind of stuff. And so how were you then able to, you know, you're talking about it had a definitive effect on the rest of your life. And I know there's a lot of people out there listening to this right now where maybe they haven't been as fortunate as you or I to play football, but they did something else. They want to become an actor or a singer or something else. That's brilliant. And that dream never became a reality, right? For whatever reason, right?
Sure.
And so what were you then able, and this place, I don't want to make this sound trivial. Like it was, you know, like a week went by and then you're out of it. This might've, you know, lasted for a long time, but what were you able to do to, like, at some point in time, create a pivot where you're starting to see the world a little bit differently? And what were those steps?
Well, in all honesty with you, from that point in late January 1977, it took me 33 years to finally find my way. It really did. And the reason it did is because I had been, you know, you're supposed to be that tough jock, tough guy. Yeah. You're supposed to bury all your shit, right? Keep it in the closet locked up. You don't let it come out. You don't let it show. You keep it hidden. You have to just keep moving on, picking yourself up and going. Well, I'll tell you what, brother, after all those years and years and years of keeping that monster, that beast locked up in the closet, it started beating down the door. And it happened on September the 20th of 2008 at a high school reunion, a 36-year reunion. And a question was asked by one of my former teammates that we shared all conference defensive honors with, who at the time just happened to be the president of Disney Motion Pictures. And it spun my memory wheel again because of my involvement in Tinseltown and pitching a TV show that ended up being on NBC for a lot of years called Sports World. And another show, The Hulk, that I was the supervising producer, I was wanted to be brought into the business in 1980. You know, and so all these things of calamity were rolling in my mind, and I'd always kept all that stuff hidden away and locked up. And even my second chance at trying to get in the NFL in 1980, playing for a local Sacramento team and all this other kind of stuff. And then losing my job in law enforcement over a medical misdiagnosis in 1977. I mean, there's so much that I had to keep locked away to keep moving on in life with a 1985, a new wife and three stepkids and all this life stuff, right? Keeps piling on and piling on and piling on. Yeah. And you're just trying to catch your spiritual air constantly. And what am I going to do? You know, and you struggle anyways, because you've got this eye deficiency and it's always kept you behind the power curve with reading retention, you know, like dyslexics kind of faced with my strabismus eyesight and all these other kind of maladies. And I'm trying to always filter and find my way through and rise to the surface out of the dark depths. And finally, that question that Mark asked me ended up on January the 20th of 2010 to be a commitment to sit down in front of my computer and start banging away on my keyboard to get this story on the page. Because throughout those years, Mark, when those happenstance occurrences arrived, and you get into those kind of deeper conversations and things start to peel back with one another and all that baggage starts kind of coming out. You know, every time, I swear, when I started to talk about my story compared to their story, they're telling me, you should write a book. You should write a book. It's going to help a lot of people. And you hear that for years and years and years. And finally, you get to a point where, you know, you've got this thing that's starting to beat and scratch and dig trying to find this light. you can't stop it. You can't suppress it any longer. You've got to let it out. And so when I started to write, it took me back to that deep, 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 deep space. And I was able to start sorting everything out and going through those old dusty filing cabinets in the hallways of my mind and pulling this file out, and pulling that other file out and resorting it and shifting it while new life experiences were happening at the same time that were enabling this writing process. And so the whole truth about finding my way, you know, it's the writing got me there. It's this writing to heal component, this journalizing thing that really kind of flipped my go switch to the what I call the God side, right. You know, and renewed my faith in the, at the same time from those earlier years that I was raised with and everything else. So, I mean, it, you know, finding your summit, finding your way has all different colors of the rainbow to it. Everybody's got their own journey, right? Mm-hmm. And you start to kick over a rock here and pull down a tree limb there. And you start seeing that pathway heading up that amazing mountain. You're trying to figure out how can I get there? You know, and then this little voice keeps calling to you, walk this way. That is what changed everything. Is this, I liken it when people ask me, Mark, I liken it to, I underwent this self-imposed, delicate open-heart surgery where I cracked my chest open and my heart and it's all those fine little frayed endings were exposed to the elements. And there are all these lightning flashes happening everywhere. And they're taking in all these surroundings around me and filling my mind and filling my soul and making me so super sensitive to everything out there that I gained this spiritual vision that I'd never had before. I mean, this is some deep stuff, dude. This is the stuff where you go sit down with these head shrinkers and mind tweakers in their office, and they put you through these other stupid scenarios that don't get to the heart of the matter. They just mind boggle you with their cycle babble. And to me, they're users and takers to benefit themselves. I want that truth, that depth, that reality of life. I want the steak. I don't want the sizzle, you know, and like I told you before we got going, Tom Flick is one of those kind of guys too. Tommy brings that with what he does and his passion for life, his new gridiron after football. Mm-hmm. See, you know, like with you and like Tom and, you know, some other guys that achieved that dream, that next step. Hey, guess what? The yellow brick road was right there and you were walking on it, dude.
Yeah.
Me? Mine blew apart. I had to figure out where the pieces all went.
Yeah, but let me go back a little bit. So number one, I think you're incredibly brave soul for coming on and sharing your story, because there's a lot of people that hold it inside, and it's really your ability to share with the world, because the person who it's unlocking in that freedom is you, right? You might inspire some others, but you're unlocking yourself. The second thing is you were talking about what really got you to a different level in terms of really realizing this whole experience that you've been through. And we all have knocks, right? And it's just like, okay, you got to pick up.
That's life, man.
That's life. And so in your case, I think something that was really interesting is that when you started talking about writing this book or journaling, right? And for me, I found a lot of my peace because I've gone through, I didn't just make up this name, Find Your Summit. I literally had to go, and it's not about climbing mountains, but I was going through my own stuff, right? And so I was just like, I needed something that was going to pull me out of it. And one of the things I never realized was this whole notion of being in nature to get calm and get your mind quiet so you can really start to digest. Yep. It's just you know, like figuring out, because the answers lie deep down inside all of us. And it's just... Yep. You know, again, you said this perfectly. You can talk to people and everything else, but at the end of the day, you're the one who holds the keys to unlock all this stuff. And if you don't take a time out in life and with yourself, because, you know, so much of the time we're like helicopters spinning around, and really understand like there's a higher purpose, but you need to stop and like understand what is there. And for me, I journal wrote, like there's, and when you're mountain climbing, you go up and you go down, you take breaks and you wait for the weather and it snows 2 feet and then you keep going and all these things. And it doesn't matter if it does it or not, but for me, nature forced me to take a time out. Right. And then I think, you know, like, look, I would love to be sitting here saying, you know what, I for sure could have played another 10, 15 years for sure. But I didn't. That wasn't my path. I played 5 years. Tom Flick, you know, former University of Washington football star quarterback, played 7 years. Maybe he could have played more. Maybe I could have played more. Maybe you could. But it all comes to an end for all of us.
Sure
and
does.
So, and so at that point in time, which I had to do, is realize that, okay, this identity that I had always seen myself, which I'm hearing a lot of the same stuff, the identity that it was Mark the football player, you know, at Roosevelt High School, the star being recruited, university, did well up there, drafted, you know, it's just like, now what? Now who are you? Right?
Right.
And
right.
For all of us, it doesn't matter who you are, you know, some more than others, it's just a heavier load to carry, especially when you're glorified. I was a wide receiver, so I was just this little punk on the outside, right?
Yeah.
You were like, you know, the character in Gladiator. I mean, you're like a big, strong defensive lineman, badass, you know, everybody's looking up to you. And that's a hard weight to come off when, you know, maybe that's not really who you are. That's your shell, but that's not your what's ticking, you know, inside. And that makes it even harder to break through just to come out and say, you know what, I'm like everybody else, man. And I got my issues. So let's talk about now it's 33 years later, you talk to this person, Mark, and he suggests like, wow, this is such powerful stuff. You need to capture this in a book. And so you've been out writing this journal. It's helped with the healing. You've mixed in some faith, which is really sounds like it's really grounded you to who you are today. What does life look like? I know you're out shopping the book and all this stuff, but what is like, forget that stuff, your day-to-day, like getting through, waking up, putting your feet on the floor, having a purpose. What does that look like for you?
Well, here's the other part of this thing too, is that the writing, you know, was that golden key to that door to the other side. Okay. But through this process, it is treacherous, bro.
It's not an easy.
Hey, man, you are opening a door and your mind sees this door with this light beaming around it and a big sign, do not enter, danger, big flashing stuff, right? Your mind doesn't want you to go there because that's control of you. And next thing you know, you say, you find the combination, you open it in there and you're pulled in this vacuum of light that's so amazing. You don't even know that it ever existed, but you always hoped it did because it's going to show you something you've always hoped and dreamed for. That's the same thing I was hoping and dreaming for when I had a childhood dream in this tangible gravity-bound space of ours that we can touch and feel with our senses and everything else, right? But I went beyond that. I went outside of that. I found my new reality. And with it, there was this force that I'd left behind that was trying to upend that whole discovery process. You see, you get to a point in this creative realm, which I call God's country. You know, it's just heaven for me, you know, and God's whispering in there. And I just don't ever want to leave, man. Yeah. I just don't ever want to leave. And so that has, you know, inserted itself into my life when I first started this thing in 2010, and it hasn't changed. So I tried to find work and do this and do that. I lost my contractor. I mean, my contractor's license got ripped away from me because of a situation with actually a former Husky football player, didn't want to pay for something and some things. And so my life was going through this shape shifting and morphing into this other entity and creature from who I'd been. And I was finding a brand new identity, that person that I was always destined to become, but hadn't seen the signs along the way. Okay. So that's the depth of this thing and the whole process. And so in the mundane day-to-day thing, who am I? Hey, I'm just a guy that fills up his gas at the gas station or goes to the grocery store and, you know, goes to church once in a while and loves to talk to my friends on the phone and share creative space with a dear novelist and screenwriter friend of mine in New York that we were supposed to go down to LA in March and pitch some stories. And we're sitting with presidents and VPs of major production companies until this COVID thing came out and blew it out of the water. I mean, the writing has opened me up to the creative world, then that realm, something that was alive in me that I never really knew about, except for, like, for instance, Mike Nycrum. I don't know if you know Stretch or not, but he was his godfather was Ben Davidson, And we were freshman teammates together. Dan Lloyd was his roommate, you know, in the crew house when we started out. And we all became thick as thieves all the way through college. And in 1987, Sonny Sixkiller called me one day and he goes, "Hey, Kev," he goes, "we're getting together a reunion between the old J.O. guys and the new James guys. And we're going to have it at the University Towers Hotel. So, you know, this is when it's going to be. Can you make it?" And I said, "Sure, Six, I'll be there, you know. I'll hustle it up and make it happen." And so I went up and I stayed with Stretch and his wife, and he's a general contractor, construction management degree, sharp as a tack, intelligent guy. And we were heading off to Federal Way to look at one of his projects. He was having a house framed, and we're driving along in his vehicle, and he kind of looks at me and he goes, "Hey, Kevy, you been doing any writing?" I hated that Kevy thing because, you know, I was a defensive lineman. I'm going to take your freaking head off. You call me that again. So I said, "No, why should I?" And he goes, "Because you're good at it." He goes, "I remember reading your stuff in college. It was really good. You should write." And I was in construction myself at that time. And, you know, with a wife and three stepkids and trying to make ends meet and everything else and barely getting by. And he's talking about writing back then. So it always been kind of in the rattle in the back of my mind. And then he kind of woke it up a little bit at that point. And I just kind of left it aside. And then as things went on, all of a sudden I get these little urges and I'll sit down and I write something. I go, "Did that come out of me? Was that really me?" And then when this quantum leap happened all those years later, you know, 10 years ago, you know, and this urging that you should write a book. And the commitment I made on that day changed everything. It brought me past that darkness in my life that I first experienced. And I got to be, I'll be totally honest with you in this regard, Mark. After that Colorado game and then got into Indiana, I was putting on second team. Whenever I'd reflect on my life, I start to get this buildup with Virginia and the big hit award. We won that game and then coming into the next game and, you know, having a great game on a regionally televised, you know, thing with, you know, was out there on ABC and having another great game and Coach Mo getting all excited about my stellar play on defense, you know, and then all of a sudden, bang, the blow up. Second team behind a freshman kid, you're teaching the ropes.
Yep.
Wait a minute. That became the biggest sticking point in my whole life that constantly had me looking back, trying to figure out what went wrong and how to fix it while I'm trying to move on in my life. Yeah. These were major PTSD issues I was experiencing, Kodak flash moments. I had no idea what they were. I just knew that I was being a pussy and I needed to be stronger to get past it all. So the writing is what really opened that door to get me there. And today, We live in Memphis, Tennessee. We left April last year out of California. You know, we needed a new beginning, and I've met friends here. You know, tried to get some work going on. You know, my wife has she's kind of bringing home the bacon for us with my little pittance of Social Security now that I'm getting because I'm an old fart. Mm-hmm. You know, but you know, it's just, you know, but right now it's like these divine doors. God keeps opening up these doors every day to keep me where I'm supposed to be until I get this book done. And then whatever happens is going to happen, of course. Mm-hmm. But I've always had this vision that with this writing thing is and this creative process is the real me and who I'm really supposed to be in life as my measure of giving back through my life experiences, the school of hard knocks, you know, how you get beat up and kicked to the curb and everything else. And you just have this thing in you that says, "Son, get up, stand up, throw your shoulders back, take a deep breath, breathe, feel your heartbeat, get to the fundamentals again, and then start your journey and keep building on that every single day." That's the process. That's the key. And the thing of it is, we all get so inundated with all the BS in life that keeps flying in our face constantly that we get overwhelmed with this blanket of nonsense, and we just need to have that breakthrough. Like, and I totally agree with you about nature, brother. I mean, I was a Boy Scout. All right. I love nature. I did a fly fishing thing 6 years ago on the Madison River up in Montana with this guy. And it was a week long adventure. And I'll tell you, it was the best week of my entire life. I wish I still had my Harley because that two wheel shrink, I throw my sweet bride in the back. We take off. I crack that throttle, man. And we're in the wide open spaces. And God just whispers to your heart in ways that just enamor you beyond imagination. So that's my summit. Finding it was the writing. you know, in a congruent measure, the way that you find your summit by experiencing the great outdoors and, you know, setting these goals about going from one summit to another one, to another one, to another one.
Yeah, no, it's very metaphorical. You know, I've done, as I mentioned, 175 or more of these podcasts. And I mean, it's incredible at the stories that I have sat and had these same, very similar conversations with. And there's a gal, Kathy Eldon, who I spoke with probably 100 episodes ago. And she had crazy stuff. She's thriving today down in Malibu, California. But, you know, when she was younger, she found herself married and two kids, and her husband left her. And then she bulimic, and then to kind of a capper, her son was in Somalia and he was stoned to death. And so she's had to go through all kinds of stuff. Like you wouldn't even
sure.
Brink of bankruptcy, all kinds. And she's a bright light and she's a wonderful soul. But the whole point of this is that she kept saying like, look, Mark, you know, we all have things happen to us. And she's had her story. I've talked to guys with no arms, no legs. I've talked to a police officer
sure.
who his car was hit and he had fourth degree burns all over his body, barely lived. You know, the stories go on and on and on.
But
the common denominator, as she was saying, was that you can't go around it. You have to go through it. And
yep.
and maybe your time frame was 33 years. My time frame was a good 10 years, right? And
yeah.
and the net is that if you can figure out a way to come through the other side, and then part of that is having this thing that you realize is your purpose being, in your case, writing, to really
yeah.
put all the emotion and really deal with those things and think about it and put pen to paper and then erase it and go back and redo the sentence or whatever you're doing. And in my case, what I'm doing and, you know, everybody else that I've talked to, they've had their own process. I think once you get that purpose, that why, that you're out there doing these amazing things, and it's just, it benefits you. And if you never sell a book or I don't make the top of Mount Everest, it doesn't matter. That what matters is that you did something that you felt was worthwhile and it made you a better person. And you
yep.
made every single person around you with that glow that you have better because of the things and the sacrifice that you went through. So look at, man, you're a fellow Fiji, a fellow Husky, a fellow brother. And I'm so thankful that you agreed to talk to me today on the pod. You've got incredible wisdom. And, you know, if there's any small advice or maybe I'm just your biggest cheerleader on the sideline, just saying, you know, keep going, keep pushing, keep going towards the light, you know, do what you're doing, because I think you're doing the right things too. And, you know, look, life isn't like, you know, you wake up, you roll out the door and hit the grave. I mean, life, if you haven't had your bumps, they're coming. I mean, I can promise you that.
Oh, it's without a doubt. I mean, that's what life is. And it's a daily embrace. I have this saying, take the ride and face it. You know, you got to get on, you got to jump in that saddle and you got to put your feet up and you got to crack that throttle. And there's days where you feel the breeze and, you know, it's an easy roll. And there's other days that are so strong and powerful. You just got to lean in between the handlebars and keep fighting against it just to get to your destination, you know, avoiding all the hazards in the road and the bends and the twists. And it's, I mean, everything's there. I mean, the other part of this thing too, is that the riding thing for me made my life metaphor rich, if that makes sense to you.
Yeah, sure does.
I mean, I was a living, I still am. I'm a living, breathing metaphor in everything that I do. I'm in a zone that I don't ever want to depart from. And so long as I keep my faith there, because I know that's where God lives and breathes, and that's the reason why we're talking today to begin with, you know. And the other thing that I really discovered too were, I made a comment earlier about signs along the way, and through all of this, I came to truly understand that I was intended to go through all these things to be a light at the end and stand on a hill to shine down towards others to help them get to their hill.
Love that.
And, you know, like a messenger of hope through words is the way that I kind of reflect on this thing. And this, what I have in my opening chapter, which was my prologue, now it's my opening chapter.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you got to go through it, the dark, to get to it, the light.
Yep.
That's the truth in all of this stuff.
Yeah.
And if you don't want to conceptualize that and walk in that vein and feel it pump that way, then you're fooling yourself. because if you don't accept that side, that light truth, you're going to continue to bump yourself and be in the shadows and, you know, fall down and crash and burn and won't understand why you keep falling the same hole over and over again. You know, like Wayne Dyer alluded to in one of his presentations that I watched at one point before he passed away. So, I mean, there's this, the thing that also really came to light in a lot of this stuff is that a little over 10 years ago, I ended up sitting at a private event in Beverly Hills next to Stephen Baldwin. And Stevie and I got to become chummy that night, you know, and everything else, and goofing around like a couple of freaking little school kids, you know. And Stephen, you know, had made a comment about, you know, he's not going to fight. And he's not going to, something like about, he's not going to live in a physical world with physical tools when it's a spiritual world that he needs spiritual tools, or something to that effect. There's a spiritual realm first that supersedes the mundane. And unless you have eyes to see that spiritual side and walk there to manage stuff, it's like you mentioned, you know, my faith grounding me. It's like, there ain't nothing wrong with having your head in the clouds and the stars, as long as you got your feet on the ground and you're taking those steps every single day.
Yeah, no, I love that.
Think from the top down, work from the ground up.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. It's a great way to end the podcast too. So where can people find you?
Where can they find me? Well, I have a LinkedIn profile. It's just Kevin James Richardson. We're Facebook friends. You know, it's Kevin James Richardson. I got 5,000 friends right now, so I'm maxed out. I'm waiting to, you know, think about flipping that switch to another page, but not until I get a bigger audience and my book is closer to be releasing. And, you know, you got to play all the pre-publishing stuff and everything else. And I had a website at one time called Commit to Believe, but I let it lapse. And so it's in the closet resting right now, and it needs to be redone. But I took out a URL called Sideline Redemption, you know, for the opening title of my book that I've got sitting in hold too. But basically, if you want to find, I got a Twitter account, Commit to Believe. So there's those, you know, you can find me on social media, but Google me, I'll come to the top of the search engines. And, you know, you can find, probably the best way for people to want to reach out to me is LinkedIn, I'd say,
sweet,
you know,
sweet,
if they wanted to connect up. So
no, I love that. Hey, listen, man, I totally appreciate you coming on the pod today. You're an inspiration. You're a shining light. Keep doing it. Keep pushing. Always here for you as a fellow satellite, Husky, Fiji, all the other boxes that you had checked along the line.
Yeah.
But it was a great chat, and I really, really appreciate it. So there he is, the one and only Kevin Richardson. Thank you.
Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. Okay, if you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, nfl.com. So, until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.
As a quarterback, I love sports, but sometimes when I get hit on my blind side, front side, and put on my backside, I wonder, is Sport Clips better than sports? Because Sport Clips Haircuts is sports on TV, plus a relaxing haircut, hot steam towel, and massaging shampoo, which is better than sports plus Sport Clips. It's a game changer. Check in online at sportclips.com.